Well, good morning. I'm David Barsamyan. I do alternative radio. I'm based in Boulder, Colorado. It's a weekly one-hour public affairs program that features dissonant voices that are usually not heard, actually rarely heard in corporate-controlled U.S. media. It's an independent program. I've been doing it since 1986. I've been doing radio since 1978. I don't have any formal training in what I do. I'm entirely self-taught. I tell you that not to boast about how brilliant I am, but this isn't rocket science or some, you know, organic chemistry that you need special training for, or brain surgery. It's just using a lot of common sense, being skeptical, having mastery over a disparate amount of information and being able to apply that in terms of interviews and producing radio programs. The project is entirely self-sustained. It has no corporate support, government support. Listeners just like you hear a program with Naomi Klein and call up the 800 number or email me and buy the tape, and that's the sole source of income. So that independence has a tremendous advantage. I can do pretty much whatever I want. I don't have to look over my shoulder and worry about Archer Daniels Midland and what they might think about a program on biotechnology, or if ExxonMobil is concerned about coverage of, you know, what they're doing in West Africa in terms of drilling offshore or whatever. So independence is a tremendous asset. It's also a liability in terms of being able to project what I'm doing. People don't know about alternative radio, like they don't know about Z Magazine. It's, you know, it's almost like Samizdat in the United States. You know, it's word of mouth. You know, we don't have full page ads in the New York Times. Time doesn't put Mike Albert on the cover, on its cover. NPR doesn't interview Noam Chomsky. You know, we're kind of below the radar screen of the corporate control media. You know, again, so advantages and disadvantages. But one of the most important things in doing an interview is knowing who your guest is and how they pronounce their name. I was interviewed on TV in Denver a couple of Wednesdays ago. I was on a panel on the liberal media. That was what it was called, the myth of the liberal media. And the host of this show, he's been doing this for like 15, 20 years. He's well established. He never checked on the pronunciation of my name, nor did his producer. And, you know, he called me Barsamyan. And that's kind of inexcusable on several levels. One is I was there an hour before. I had spoken to his producer several times, you know, in the preceding weeks, and they just could have checked that how you ID yourself, you know, director of alternative radio, author of da-da-da, and how do you pronounce your name? It's very embarrassing, if you imagine, to be doing a live interview and having to be corrected on the air. You know, it's not Vilka, it's Vilka. Sorry. Oh, I didn't check. So knowing who your guest is and their ID and being very clear about that, that was pretty dramatic. That this guy didn't take the time, and he's got a full-time producer, you know, to check. And that was it was a kind of interesting show because we were trying to deconstruct this myth of the liberal media, a notion that is so deep in the aquifer of American consciousness that, you know, it requires, you know, almost like a Dracula-like test, you know, to drive a knife through the heart of this shibboleth, which is repeated constantly in the media. In fact, that might lead to a very good interview. You know, how does a myth get established? You know, what is the evidence? Let's say you were a conservative talk show host and I was doing an interview, or a conservative ideologue, you know, like Liz here from Madison, which is a very, you know, right-wing conservative town in you know, the Midwest. They just drink beer. Well, let's see. So, none of those things. So, okay, Liz, you're this conservative ideologue. You teach media studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. You've written many books on the topic of the liberal media. Could you give us some examples of the liberal media? You know, what as a concrete, in a concrete way?
Well, I mean, look at all the press they had about Clinton after Bush was in office. I mean, the press is just enamored with Clinton.
But wasn't most of that criticism was actually from a right wing perspective? You know, that Clinton was doing things in a moral area which offended the right wing. But his policies.
The New York Times is a right wing perspective. Come on, the New York Times is the most liberal paper out there. That's supposed to be the voice, you know, whatever's fit to print.
Well, do you see that reflected in its editorial policy?
Yeah.
Could you give some examples?
Well, they.
This is where you catch people. You see, because then I'm not trying to catch her. I mean, we're playing a little game here. But whenever you have some rhetorical position, you know, like all brunettes are happy, or people who wear glasses are cool. Okay, so here's your sentence, right? People who wear glasses are cool. What's the evidence for that? What documentation do you have to fortify your assertion that people who wear glasses are cool? You know, you've got to be able to make it very concrete. It puts people on the spot in a very practical way. And it helps flesh out the topic. Feel free to interject and, you know, ask questions. Don't be passive here. We've got, you know, a short amount of time. So use me.
Just want to say, sometimes we were doing election night coverage, and someone was running for office against Tammy Baldwin, who's an out lesbian in Congress, and one of his campaign ploys was to, it was a really, really awful ad, and that was anti-Semitic and homophobic, and so there had been a movement to call him on it, and so it was election night, we had him on the air, and I was like, well, how are you going to what's your response to these charges from these community groups about, you know, this issue? And he was like, oh, well, you know, my daughter lives in West Hollywood, and she's half Jewish. But it's important to say, well, that doesn't answer the question. And I think that's what happens a lot, that people don't answer the question. I think it's very important to say, well, that doesn't answer the question, and to throw it back at them. And he was stumped.
Being ready with a follow-up, you know, being ready to improvise is an important part of any interview. And don't forget, you are the director of this art form. And this is an art form. You just don't, it's not a conversation. It's not, you know, I meet you at the, Swope's dining hall and we're having a little chat while we're waiting to get our, you know, dinner. That's a little, you know, informal chat. But when we're doing an interview, whether it's on video or for print or for radio, you have a certain amount of time to create a bouquet, to create a floral wreath, if you will, of various colors and textures. What are you going to do as the florist, because that's your role, to create a bouquet that is most attractive and informative and will take your listeners or your viewers or your readers from point A to, say, point D? I mean, I'm not going to be ambitious and say it's like from A to Z or A, you know, A to Z. But what is your direction? An interview should have a trajectory. It should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if you could see it also like a pyramid, like this. Yeah.
I was wondering, to what extent do you give the person you're interviewing an idea of what sorts of questions you're going to ask beforehand? Or do you do that at all?
I just did an interview with Amartya Sen of India. He's a Nobel Prize winner in economics. He wanted to see all my questions in advance, and I just declined. I said, I don't do that. I don't do it for anyone. I didn't do it for Arundhati Roy. I don't do it for Angela Davis or Noam Chomsky. You know, it takes away the spontaneity and the healthy panic, as Avi Lewis of Counterspin says, of a live interview. I think that's very healthy. You know, if the person is well informed and has got something to say, they'll be able to respond.
Yes, but maybe the people that you are interviewing, they may have some knowledge that they want you to ask them about, because it's important for them, and you want to interview them because you know that they have certain things that could be helpful. Is it important also to ask them, are there things you want me to ask you?
I would ask that, you know, on a ad hoc basis, depending on the person. If it's in an area I don't know a lot about, like science, then I'm much more dependent on the skills of the person I'm interviewing rather than on my own knowledge. You know, if it's about globalization or the media or topics that I have some command over, I can generate a lot of questions. But let's say it's, you know, in a couple of weeks I'm going to be interviewing Vandana Shiva in Santa Fe. She's from India. She's a big environmentalist. I don't know if you're familiar with her. I've published interviews with her in The Progressive as well as Z Magazine and have done a number of radio programs with her. There was a very critical article about her in the current New York Review of Books, which essentially says she doesn't know what she's talking about when it comes to biotechnology. And so I want to see if she knows about this critique of hers. And then I want to draw out, well, how do you respond to Jane Allison's contention that you exaggerate the dangers of biotechnology and GMO foods? So that would be, you know, one example. But when I'm talking about, with Shiva, because she's a scientist, she's a biophysicist, that's not like one of my strong points. You have to know, it's not weakness to say you don't know, you know, a lot about a certain topic. In fact, it's a strength because you're not pretending. So there, you know, I'm trying to find out, you know, what this person knows and how to get it out. And with Shiva, you know, I'm already starting the pre-interview in my brain. And I write down little notes, let's say, during the day, and I'm thinking, this will be an interesting topic to talk about. I might ask her about Arundhati Roy and the movements against the dam, the big dam projects in India. You know, why Shiva, who's a big environmentalist in India, why she hasn't gotten involved in that movement? You know, there may be a myriad of reasons, you know, no time, overcommitted, you know, overcommitment, things like that. But I would like to know what her opinion is of what Roy calls the grandest, most brilliant resistance movement since Mahatma Gandhi did Satyagraha in India in the 1930s and 40s. So I'm already like thinking about Shiva in my mind, and that's coming up in a couple of weeks. I also wanted to show you the tools of the trade. A very simple microphone, the microphone that I recorded Ron Daniels with last night. It's a professional Electra Voice. It's shock-mounted, which means that the microphone element inside here, in this frame here, is isolated. So if I'm in, it's Bruce, right? If I'm interviewing Bruce here and going back and forth, well, what about this, Bruce? And how come you decide to wear red today as opposed to your green T-shirt? There's no mic noise. And those kinds of things are, when you're doing a, you know, radio or TV, the mic noise is very irritating. It's like clunk, clunk, you know, and it really becomes, even with digital editing, it becomes impossible to edit out. Because if you're speaking over the noise, it's different when you go like this and there's clunk. Okay, you can edit out the clunk. If it's not live, if it's live, it's going out. It's being broadcast. But the fact that it's shock-mounted, it means it's isolated, so there'll be no mic noise. The listener or the viewer does not want to know about any of the technical things going on. They want to hear what, you know, Vilka has to say about Greek politics, or what, you know, what that big demonstration was like when Madeleine Albright and...
Sandy Berger and William Cohen
went to Ohio State University in this fantastic interview on CNN Live, where there was a huge uproar in the audience. That's what people want to know that. Well, you know, we're having technical problems today. Our tape jammed. You know, those kinds of things. Yeah. Nothing like that. Also, to really make a guest, particularly someone who's a community activist who may not be very comfortable with the media. This may be, you know, she may be working at the battered women's center in town, so she's not like a trained media person. And then, you know, you're saying, well, let me see here. I'm not sure if I got this tape recorder working here. And,
can you say that again? I didn't get that.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, this is the first time I ever used this machine. Let me see if I can get it to work. So meanwhile, this person's thinking, you know, who is this turkey? I'm already a nervous wreck. I've never been on the radio before. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. So what you're doing is just like heightening tension to the bursting point. So one thing we need to all be, no matter where we're working in, be it metallurgy or carpentry or dentistry or radio or video, we need to be masters of our tech, bar none. We never want to get, as Avi Lewis of Canada says, caught with our microphones down. And so we need to have the technology serve us, and we need to be in absolute control of it a priori, not on the job training while you do. Oh, let me see. If I turn this up, is that light working? Do you think this will? Let me see if, you know, this is like disaster. So spending time, you know, with your technology and understanding it, feeling comfortable with it, and it's your toy, because this is your vehicle. This is how you're going to convey, you know, whatever is going to come out, be it, you know, a series of radio interviews with Noam Chomsky that turns into a book, for example, or an interview I did with Arundhati Roy in the back seat of a car driving from Amherst to Logan Airport in Boston, you know, in a very difficult situation, with, you know, my notes here, kind of, and then the roar of the car and the highway, and trying to stay focused, you know. So having this technology working on your, you know, totally, and you're totally in control of it. This microphone's about $150. This Sony DAT. That means digital audio tape, which is the preferred medium now for professionals in the field to record on DAT or mini discs. It is not the preferred medium for consumers. There are no DAT players in cars. People don't walk into their kitchens and pop on their DAT machine to listen to the latest, you know, Amy Goodman Democracy Now! Tape. Cassettes are still very, very popular, and CDs as well. So DATs are being used for professional use, but have very, because of the expense.
How much is that?
Yeah. This machine is around $800.
Oh, yeah.
Right. The microphone's $150, $200. So there's $1,000 right there for hardware.
How do you spell that? DAT?
DAT, yeah. Uppercase.
Is that a radio mic?
This is a broadcast quality microphone. Yeah. That's shock mounted. One thing, and it also has a built-in windscreen. So a built-in windscreen has the advantage of when people are popping peas, and people in Pakistan are very poor, the peas are not...
The pea poppers
and the sibilant hisses.
Yes.
The sisses, you know, the sisters in Saskatchewan who have, you know, this guy, sisters... That cuts that out. So shock mount, you may sometimes see broadcasters roll a sock over the thing. That's to cut down on the wind noise when you're out in the field. Like I used this for Ron Daniels last night, and that was a broadcast quality recording. This is an omnidirectional mic, which means the pattern is like this, so that even when Daniels sort of went, you know, a little bit here, a little bit here, which is on mic, and a little bit here, the whole range is picked up. It's good to have an omnidirectional microphone to do an interview, as opposed to the other type, which is called a cardioid. A cardioid, as it suggests, is a very narrow kind of wavelength. So if you're slightly off, if I'm interviewing...
You're going to hear this noise over here, right, instead of this noise.
He literally is dropping out. I mean, it sounds like he's back at 18 Millfield Street. You know, and I'm on mic, and I'm very clear and full range, you know, full broadband, and he's like, you know, this distant sound. That kind of, you know, again, that really puts the listener off, and they're gone. Because of the way media are today, and because we're all time impaired, most people aren't going to wait for David to get his act together. Well, maybe the next question, you know, he'll have his tape recorder at the right level, and I'll just wait because I'm patient. No, they're gone. They're in their car, they're looking for the next thing. Hey, I don't need this. Let's see, maybe I can find some music. So again, you know, being a master of the tech is absolutely important.
And that mic is actually cordless?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
No, no, I didn't bring the connector.
Okay, so
it's not a cordless mic.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a connected mic. There's just a little, you know, cord between here and there. But so last night's program, I'm already anticipating that I will produce that. He spoke for about 70 minutes. My program's an hour. I have an intro and an outro, so I'll probably have to edit out about 15 or 18 minutes, which will be fairly easy. And that'll be a radio program, you know, something that you heard last night.
Who makes that mic?
This is made by ElectroVoice. And it's an industry standard mic. It's called an RE50. And you can get it from Full Compass in Madison or CCI in Olympia, Washington. They both have 800 numbers. I'm not a big fan of lapel mics, which are put, you know, like, attached to you. Okay, let's take this, for example. It just happened to me, right? Or a woman wearing a silk blouse with a V-neck. Okay, you put this, like, piece of metal here like this, so the mic is, like, down to here now. And, like, I'm really nervous, and I'm, you know, touching here, and all of that gets picked up. So this mic is quiet. Lapel mics have certain applications that are really good when people know exactly what they're doing. And
might
you know
be a little better for video than that. If
yeah. 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 This is not a great video, you know, prop. Yeah. And lapel mics, when you've got people sitting back, like that when I was interviewed, when the guy mispronounced my name, there were three other people. We were all sitting around a table. We all had lapel mics. Because you can't really be going around with microphones, you know, right on TV.
I've had people come back after doing a field recording and having an awful recording because they let the other person hold on to the mic. They would just pass it to them, and then the other person isn't used to speaking, so they're kind of all over the place. And then another thing about mini discs, you can get them for about $200 or under at places like that. Spawn, stuff like that, you can find mini discs players. It would be more reasonable.
Yeah, mini discs are much cheaper.
How much?
About $200. We've gotten some for $175.
The DAP?
No, mini discs.
Okay. Just digital audio.
Yes, right, the mini digital.
What's on the floor, what Maria has on the floor. That's
okay.
The mini disc.
But with those, one thing to just mention, my first, I'm just getting used to this myself, my batteries ran out while I was recording something, and I lost everything on the disc because it's like a computer disc. It has to save the...
How much can you get on?
About 70. It's like a CD length.
Yeah.
But I'm like right now I'm recording mono on there, and you get twice as much.
Time, yeah.
Okay.
So last night I had a 125-minute DAT, you know, 2 hours and 5 minutes. You know, I knew Daniels wasn't going to, you know, would not speak for more than, say, an hour and 15 minutes and then the Q&A. So I got you know, virtually everything. And I used power. Should always use power. Have batteries as a backup, but not as a front up.
Right.
Batteries fail, and they're very unforgiving. In analog as well as digital recording. It's not like, you know, you're getting a gradual fade and you've got like, you know, it just drops out. It's gone and you've got nothing. And that's a disaster. I mean, just imagine this. I mean, the situation last night, right? I'm recording Daniels and the DAT failed, you know, or I failed to put on the record level, you know, so I had the thing on, but the record level wasn't up. And so what are you going to do? Hey, Ron, could you come back tomorrow and could we do it? You know, what are your options, realistically speaking? It's gone. In fact, he's literally gone.
Well, I noticed this was checking it quite a bit last night.
Because he was really blowing into it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there was a lot of peaks and valleys, and I wanted to check the modulation. Another problem with DAT, as opposed to analog, is DAT is very unforgiving when it's getting too much sound. It cuts out. It's what the technical term in radio jargon is like. It doesn't have much headroom to absorb sound surges. whereas analog does have headroom and absorbs sound surges. So imagine your tape, any tape. This is analog tape, right? Naomi Klein, no logo. Let's get to the actual tape.
Do you ever use like a compressor sort of thing?
No.
I mean, I know they have.
I don't. Right, I don't like the artificiality of a compressor. I want to get as close to the human voice as I can without that kind of technical intervention. It has some application. It's used much more in music than in voice. So here's, you know, your typical analog tape. It has a certain amount of capacity. Imagine it's like this cup, right? So what kind of signal do you want to get to your tape? Is there any tape, DAT or this kind, or to the, let's say you're burning a CD. You know, if you're imagining it, then let's say this is an 8-ounce glass. We can use the horrible American system. And, you know, you're just getting 1 ounce of liquid in here. So you're 7 ounces short. You're not really utilizing this cup. You're not getting a real good, you know, your thirst is not getting slaked. Then you're moving up, you know, halfway. Okay, so you got half the capacity of the tape is now being utilized. And then you're up further, and now you're over the top. Now you're getting very, very thirsty, and you're sending a signal into the glass that's spilling over onto the floor and you know, becoming a total mess. The tape has lost the capacity to absorb the signal, and you get distortion. In the case of DAT, it just cuts out. So I could be speaking and that's DAT. In analog, does anyone have an analog? Well, this is an analog. Let's say that we were using this as a tape recorder. You would get a huge surge in volume that would make the whole thing so blurry you couldn't make. There would be no resolution of sound because the tape has lost the ability to absorb. You've miscalculated the amount of liquid you had and versus the capacity of the glass. So with Daniel's last night, a couple of times he was going like right into the mic at very high volume. Mm-hmm. I had to jump up and lower it a little bit because I wanted to avoid those kinds of peaks.
Do you have any way on there to monitor when the signal's blowing out, or is
It has their LED, readouts, and you want to keep it at a certain level. In the case of DAT, it's around 10 or plus 10 or plus 12 on this. You know, it can take some peaking. It can take some surges. It's natural. Like, I'm not speaking in a monotone. And when I just rose a few minutes ago, I was more animated and there was more volume in my voice. Simply because when you stand, you can generate more energy and you start using your hands. Which is, when I'm recording speakers in the field, I always insist that they stand up, because they can generate more energy, and there's more action in the mic. Like the Daniels program, that recording last night, that will be a terrific recording, you know, not because I'm smart or anything, because he was moving around also, and that creates peaks and valleys in the sound stream. And that, for you as a listener, becomes very attractive. It's like a mosaic of sound. You know, it creates texture. It's not like one person speaking into the microphone in a monotone like this, which will very soon get you terribly bored and not captivated. But rather, I'm now talking to Bruce. Now I'm shifting over to Tani. Now I'm going over to... Rick, sorry. And, you know, moving around like this, creating action. And that action translates into audio texture. Now, when we're doing radio particularly, that's our weapon. That's our ace. That's our main card, is audio texture. We don't have images. You know, we don't have, faces. We don't have props. We don't have background. We don't have anything. So that's our image. We're trying to create... you know, an audio picture. And so that kind of thing is very helpful when, you know, someone is giving a speech standing up. And Daniel's, you know, as I mentioned, is a drop-dead speaker. I've done 3 or 4 programs with him. They always do very, very well. People are very interested in someone, even if they don't agree with what he's saying, that is able to use oratory in that fashion as an art, you know, as an art form, as a presentation. It's very, very attractive. Like Arundhati Roy also is a wonderful speaker. Naomi Klein of Canada, she did a book called No Logo. And I did a program around that, and I recorded her a couple of weeks ago at a public talk. Again, the same kind of thing. There was a lot of dynamics. There was this moving around, and this mic is very forgiving because it has a broad spectrum to get the sound, as opposed to those other microphones. As soon as you move over like this, it's like total dropout. And
well, could you talk just a tiny bit more about this having people stand up? I'm just picturing you go over to. You know, you go over to Noam's house and you say, "Sorry, Noam, you got to stand up now." And
no, I don't do that.
Yeah, I know. The interviews, but you're saying that you would do that with some people,
not for interviews.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for recording speeches or debates and those kinds of situations, I think you can generate a lot more energy. So the dynamic in an interview is more. It's a conversation. It's a give and take. It's not a stand up and deliver. You know, this is the Dharma. This is how I see the world. This is my view of racism. This is my view of structural capitalism. This is how I see the media. That's a stand up and deliver kind of thing. So the context is different in a conversation. Now you'll see with Chomsky when he speaks on Tuesday night, he's not a charismatic speaker. He doesn't use modulation. He's got a monotone voice. What makes Chomsky attractive to so many people, particularly in the U.S. and Canada, is the sheer weight of his argument and the density and the power of his information. His ability to master a disparate amount of information from a wide variety of sources, synthesize it for us, and present it. So that's not oratory. That's a very different thing. I mean, you could hardly imagine Chomsky doing a kind of Ron Daniels performance. you know,
to watch him try.
it would. You know, it's a very different style, and so you need to be aware of what people's capacities are, you know, in terms of that. Angela Davis, for example, she could read from the phone book, and you'd be bouche bée, your jaw would drop. What a voice, what an instrument. You know, just spectacular. I did a program with Martin Espada on poetry and politics. He's a Puerto Rican, U.S.-born, Puerto Rican origin writer and poet. He teaches at UMass Amherst. Great voice, great delivery, wonderful modulation, peaks. Why do I mean modulation? Peaks and valleys, you know, when that meter is doing things. It's not just staying in one spot all the time, not moving at all in a very straight kind of way. Again, it doesn't create the audio patterns that might, you know, bring in listeners to saying, yeah, I want to hear what this person has to say. This sounds really interesting. So that's, you know, being sensitive to those kinds of things is really important. About the interview style, everyone has their own style. You should be listening to people, reading their interviews, listening to them on the CBC or public radio or WBAI in New York or whatever, and see what other people are doing. I mean, I learned a lot as a kid growing up. I didn't know I was doing this, but I was addicted to Edward R. Murrow and Mike Wallace. Mm. And I would watch all their, you know, news documentaries and interview shows. And I was just seeing what they were doing, how they were, like, improvising. How did they keep it going? I mean, I found that so, you know, live broadcast. These are not, like, you know, pre-recorded, taped. You know, you cut and paste, and then everybody sounds really smart. You know, there are no uhs and dead air or anything like that. And I was just fascinated to see, you know, the ability, just in terms of pacing, to forward an agenda. Maybe I didn't agree with the content at all. And in most cases, you know, particularly today with the corporate controlled media, I hate the way they do things. I despise Charlie Rose. He's just awful. Jim Lehrer on the NewsHour is the most boring interview anywhere in North America. I mean, it's hard to, you know, he's really in a class by himself. He said, there should be a statute of limitations on boredom. I don't know how these guys get jobs and then keep them. How do they keep them? How does Charlie Rose keep a job? When he gets Edward Said on the air, he doesn't let Said speak finish sentence because he doesn't agree with him. When he gets someone on that he agrees with, like Thomas Friedman, you know, saying that, you know, Arabs are terrorists, they like to kill little girls and school children, they have nothing better to do like to blow up buses. And the Rose is there, you know, nodding, because he's agreeing. When he gets on someone, when the guest is someone like he disagrees with, you can't finish a sentence. What about? Oh, yeah, right. What about this professor? What about those little kids that were, you know, all those kinds of things, you know, where he would never interrupt Friedman and say, well, what about these Palestinian homes that were bulldozed? What about this land that was annexed over here? What about these? What about this five-month-old baby that was shot? How do you explain that? Never asked. So, I mean, there you see ideology also intersecting with interviewing. But it's also a very bad technique, you know, because you're not really providing the listener with any kind of background, with any kind of, some energy, you know, into the situation, rather than saying, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, the most deadly, unthinking comments, if you really want to turn people off, you know, and you tell you, you know, you're right. Those are my thoughts exactly. Or, I'm sure our listeners agree. Deadly, with six E's at the end. Deadly. Or, you know, I'm sure everybody knows that. How do you know that? Do you know that Regina is the capital of Saskatchewan? Most listeners don't. Or do you know that the NDP party was just crushed in British Columbia? You know, most Americans don't know that kind of stuff. So you can't make statements like, I'm sure everybody knows, or it's well known. How is it well known? I mean, there's some obvious things, you know, like B follows A. You don't have to say that. But some things are not well known. Like, do people know the differences between GMOs and HMOs? Let's say I'm doing an interview here and we're talking about GMOs and HMOs. Well, can we have a definition of what those things are? Once, please, just to get that in circulation. Let's say he's, you know, he's a scientist and, you know, he's using technical terms and GATT this and NAFTA that and FTA this and GMOs that. You need to be there for the audience, not for yourself. So you're smart, you know all these acronyms. But, yeah, you know, who is your average listener or reader? You have to think about them and not show that, you know, you're so clever and you're so smart. Well, GMO, what is that? You know, what does GMO stand for? Or if you know, does genetically modified organisms, right?
So is that what you do? You'll kind of come in and you'll say, can you explain that? Is that how you'll do it?
What's a GMO? What's the difference between GMO and MO? Okay. You know, HMO. Is GATT part of the WTO? And what does GATT stand for?
General Agreement on Trade Tariffs.
Chomsky gets the Multilateral Agreement on Investments. He always pluralizes the investments. And it's not, it's a singular. Multilateral Agreement on Investment. It's a pretty common mistake. MAI. Yeah.
One of the reasons of doing those kind of things, tell us what that means. You know, somebody makes a kind of an arcane thing. Is you're trying to recruit new listeners, too. You may have some regular listeners that have followed this issue, but you're not going to grow the audience if you're assuming that just the core set are the ones that are, you know, how are the new people going to be tapped in and catch on with this stuff and getting to repeat that definition?
So seeing your role, who are you? Are you this really smart person, and you may be, that is very informed about corporate media? Last Saturday, let me give you a perfect example. My sitar teacher was visiting me in Boulder. I'd studied Indian music in a past life. And I was going to do an interview with him. And I had to convince him to see me as a total blank, someone absolutely ignorant that knew nothing about Indian music. because I was going to ask him these kind of, you know, leading questions. Well, what's a raga? How did this music evolve? Why is it that Indian music, certain ragas are played at a certain time? What's the idea behind that? It was difficult for him. In the first 15 minutes, twice he said, as you know. See, he lost that. He lost seeing me as a blank wall, and then he started seeing me as David, his student, who had studied with him for many years, who knew all these things. Right? So I stopped, because it wasn't a live interview, I stopped the tape recorder, and this is one advantage of a, you know, pre-recorded and not live. And I just told him, I said, you got to see, I know nothing, see me as a blank wall. And then he didn't do it again for another, for the whole hour, for the rest of the hour. And so I did that interview on Indian music, a rather obscure topic. And so I was asking very leading questions, the kinds of questions you would ask. What is a raga? How is it expressed? You know, what is the background of this music? What is the history of the sitar? How many strings does it? You know, stuff like that. Leading questions to draw out answers. It wasn't an antagonistic interview, you know, in a way, because it was more of a cultural interview. So it wasn't like, how do you know that? What's the evidence? Can you give some example? Well, that is an ongoing question. You know, if he says, you know, Indian music is very spiritual, how is it spiritual? You know, can you give an example? You know, is it spiritual in theory but not in practice? I mean, how do you articulate spirituality in your plectrum when you strum a string? That's actually a very hard question. You know, but again, it's a good question because it's drawing out, you know, examples. And because a cultural interview is different from a political interview, you know, it has a different flavor to it. Yeah? Yeah.
I've noticed in television interviews the technique that sometimes it seems like there's an awkward silence, and then that will cause the person being interviewed to say something really, what you really want them to, you know, to go beyond. But can you do that in radio?
If there's a silence?
Yeah, can there be any kind of silence?
Silence is good. I'm not afraid of silence. I'm much more critical of silence fillers, like you know what I really want to ask you is the other day I was thinking about would you mind if you know, those kinds of things? Why are you trying to formulate a question? Yeah. You're just filling the air with dead air, with deadness. You know, and I'm not afraid. I think we can use silences, you know? Like when I was interviewing my mother, which was the very first interview I ever did, and probably the most difficult interview, because when you're interviewing a loved one, you know, someone who's close to you, you know, about something very painful, because she went through the massacres in 1915 in Armenia, and I got her to describe, you know, how she had to abandon her parent. Now, as I'm saying it, I'm like, losing it, just telling you. You know, so it was very, when she talked about that, there was silence, and I didn't say anything. Because that should sink into people. Right? That she abandoned her mother and her three, I can't even replicate it. Her three younger brothers left on a roadside to die. Because they were just too ill to continue. And so just let that be. Don't fill it with some inane, you know, comment. And be sensitive to that moment. You know, and not like go on to some, you know. And then when you come to the United States? You know, or, and you met your husband later and got married? What was that like? Duh. You know. I mean, being able to improvise is, you know, important, and being sensitive. The art of doing an interview is also being a very good listener. Mm-hmm. Listening for the cracks and crevices in people's voices. Like, if you were interviewing me right now, I just gave you an enormous opening. You know, why was I, like, breaking up there for a few seconds? Is this, like, profoundly, am I profoundly connected to that material? Yes. So that would give you an opening. Trying to find those, and also trying to ask the questions that, with my mother was very difficult, because she knew I knew everything about it. You know, why were we doing this interview? Well, I was doing it was a historical archive kind of thing. I wanted to get this recorded before she died. So, you know, it was serving that purpose. So it was. I had to do the same thing I did with my sitar teacher. You are not talking to me. You are talking to a blank wall. You know, like, I know why the genocide happened, but I need to ask you why you think it happened. Things like that. So, you know, when I asked you that initial question about, you know, have you ever done any interviews? You've all done interviews, but they haven't been formalized. You're interviewing everyone all the time at the, you know, at the dinner line at Swopes. Where are you from? You know, how'd you hear about ZMI? You know, the kinds of questions. Those are all interviews. I mean, it's not formalized. It's not for broadcast. It's not for print. But we are conversing. We are interrogating. That's what interviewing is about. And so it should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You should have an agenda. And this, you know, don't get confused about this. You are the director. You're in charge of this art form. And you want to take it from a certain place and get to a certain place. You don't want to have a half an hour as, for example, let's say you have a 30-minute program. And I heard this, actually. It's right off of Democracy Now! Amy Goodman had Chomsky on. And this is how she began the final question. Noam, first of all, to call someone by their first name in an interview, no matter if you're very intimate with them, is very off-putting to the audience, because it shows a friendship and a personal relationship that immediately says, oh, look, they're tight, man. They're buds.
In this together.
They're buds. Yeah. Right, yeah. They're cool. You know, they're having a private conversation. So, you know, I've interviewed, you know, Chomsky, you know, 800 times. As soon as the mic goes on, he's Noam Chomsky. I don't say, hey, Noam. You know, what's shaking, dude? Yeah. Maybe I should.
Just once. Just
once. That would really throw him off. But for the listener, you want to create distance. So with a minute left, Noam, we've got about 30 seconds left.
What? Yeah.
What is your theory about linguistics?
Well,
yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Now, that's a great question. That's a good question, perfectly legitimate. But think about the architecture of your program now, where you are. You're almost at the top of the pyramid. You've run out of time. You know any kind of answer is going to be very complicated and necessarily verbose. You know, I mean, this is not like, you know, where, you know, what's the title of your next book? Oh, Propaganda in the Public Mind. Great. Okay, done. That could be your last question. So, strategic error. That kind of question needs to come at the bottom of the pyramid.
Could you talk more about
that? As you're working your way up in terms of time. A theory of linguistics is not a simple question or answer. Like, you know, what was the last movie you saw? What's the next book you're reading? You know, what are you having for lunch? I mean, those are like one-liners. You can get them out of the way. And those, you know, good ways to end interviews. You know, what book are you working on a new book? Or you're in Madison, you're interviewing Chomsky, you know, live at WRT. Where are you going to from Madison? Oh, my next stop is Boulder. I'm going to be giving a talk there at the university tomorrow night. Yeah, okay, so it gives it some closure. Yeah, somebody had...
Well, I was just wondering, yeah. Could you talk more about this pyramid? You know, I know people talk about an inverted pyramid for, like, newspaper writing. What are you talking about?
Well, that's... You know, I'm using it as a metaphor. You know, maybe you can create something that you're more comfortable with. But I'm looking at an interview that has a base at the beginning, and where you have a minimalist and a maximalist agenda of questions. You've got a half hour or one, let's say 1 hour, right? In that, let's just work with a half hour format. You've got your five questions that you've absolutely got to get in. Okay, the royal family of Nepal has just been assassinated. Professor Sin, you know, what's the background to this issue? What is the media saying about it that, you know, that we're not hearing? What are your personal views on this topic? You know, what prompted? Let's say you have like five basic questions that you want to get out for your audience. Then if those questions are answered satisfactorily and they don't generate other questions, and you're still watching the clock, you're still managing the clock, you can now move to your maximalist agenda, you know, where you can flesh out more things about the history of the monarchy in Nepal. What is the relationship between India and Nepal? Which is actually a good question because it's very contentious. People in Nepal feel that India is a hegemon. It's an imperial power. It's dominating Nepal. And, you know, so, like the way the most of the third world sees the U.S., except for Americans who don't see themselves that way. So that relationship between India and Nepal. So you move then to, and you're watching this, you're watching the clock, you're setting an agenda, you're trying to move, you have a trajectory of ideas, and you want to have closure at the end. So a question on Nepal, let's say this massacre, that would not be, you know, like, what can people do about this issue, is not a good closure question, because there's not much we can do about it. It's an internal matter unique to that situation. But let's say, and you know, I'll be interviewing Vandana Shiva in a couple of weeks, and we're talking about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and you know what's happening with the corporatization of food. There, a closure question, you know, one to sort of end it with toward a trajectory is, well, you know, what can people do about it? Because you know that there are organizations, both national and international, that are working on this particular issue, like in Canada, the Council of Canadians, for example, or Public Citizen, or, you know, Third World Resurgence in Penang. There are all kinds of national and international organizations that are working on this particular issue. So you can say, you can go to their website, you can buy this book, you can read South End Press, Stolen Harvest. There are practical things that people can do. Some things don't lend them, you know, some topics don't lend themselves. Like if I were to do this thing on Nepal, I was just thinking about that, just improvising. You know, there's not much anyone can do in this room about that. I mean, you could get the information, you could suss it out, you could figure out, you know, what the motives were, what the implications are. There's not much we can do sitting in Woods Hole, you know, but there are things we can do about the U.S. media. There are things we can do about corporate control. There are things we can do about GMOs, yes. There are things we can do about the city council that passed a resolution last night, you know, imposing a 10 o'clock curfew on teenagers, which has happened in certain U.S. cities. Yes.
If your last question turns out to spark too much of a comment and you're running out of time and you really got to cut somebody off, do you have any advice for how to stop somebody who doesn't seem to be pausing and, you know, tell them, like, our time's up?
Well, yeah, if you're holding them, if it's a radio interview, it's pretty simple. You know, we're like, well, we're running out of time now.
Just take it away.
Yeah, yeah.
Mid-sentence, if need be.
If need be. Yeah, no, the clock is driving you. The program that I do, Alternative Radio, it's on the satellite. It's not more than 58 minutes. It can't be more than 58 minutes because the satellite channel literally clears and you get... So if you're a radio station downloading my program in Martha's Vineyard or wherever, or in New York, and, you know, it's 58:02, I'm in mid-sentence and I'm... you just can't do it.
Make sure that the person you're interviewing, if you're live on the
link,
can see the clock and, you know,
is watching. You're managing the clock.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, you're managing, and also one thing you should also do is, if you're going to use any hand signals, make them clear in advance, not while you're going along. I did it in a live interview once on the air. I did this, which meant, you know, like, wind it up, close it down, and the guy stopped in mid-sentence because I didn't rehearse signals, you know, like cut or stop, you know, like I want to ask a question, you know, like stop. So if you're going to do any hand signals, they should know about it, you know, in advance. No surprises. Again, you know, it's live. Live is like healthy panic, right? You know, live is, you know, it's good because it's healthy panic, but it's fraught with danger. because you could really crash. You know, if these kinds of things happen when you're pre-recording, let's say, we're doing a, pre-recorded interview now, we can stop and start, we can edit, cut and paste, you know, make the listener, make the interviewee sound really coherent. So if the question starts in Halifax and ends in Victoria, it's too long of a question. So you compress it and just stop it at, let's say, Toronto. So you have this question here, right there. Danger points that interviewers fall into is being a prisoner of verbosity or their own cleverness, and want to impress the audience. I know everything about this topic. I've studied it carefully. I've actually got a PhD in it, and I've written several books. And, my opinion is actually this. And do you agree? So now here you have a total confusion of the role of the interviewer and the interviewee. In this case, I want to be on the other side. I want to be the pundit. I want to be the one that's being interviewed. I don't want to be the interviewer because I'm so smart and I know everything. So that is something you see a lot of in interviews. And one of the things, here's the text of an interview I did with Edward Said a couple of weeks ago in Santa Fe. And you have the interview I did with Stuart Ewan in the packet I handed out to you. You can see there should be a nice architecture between question and answer. If you see a question this long and the answer this short, just as a musician, there's some dissonance here. You're out of tune big time. That architecture is not right. You're taking up too much of the musical space and the guest is not participating enough. So you want to actually, when you have a transcription like this, you want to see question, response, question, response, question, response. It keeps the focus on the interviewee. That's who you're paying attention to, not to yourself. This is not an opportunity to show how smart you are. You want to be informed. You don't want to say, is Toronto the capital of Canada? You should come to the table knowing that I think probably most Americans think Toronto is the capital of Canada because it's the largest city. But you want to come to the table informed about Ottawa being the capital. And it's a parliamentary system, not who's the head of your Congress. So you want to have some homework done in advance to cut off a lot of, dead air. Yeah.
You gave an example of how Charlie Rose will interrupt and try...
If he doesn't agree with someone.
And you've given examples of how you get someone to elaborate, but if someone's taken off on a tangent that you really don't want to go on, how do you make
it? As you just said, that's a very interesting question, but I want to refocus the topic in the limited amount of time we have. Can we get back to the WTO and its next ministerial meeting in Qatar? What can people do about that? Okay, meanwhile, you've gone off on an article that appeared in your local paper, which you took umbrage to, written by some, activist that you thought was flawed. I don't want to diss you and say, hey, jerk, that's not what we're talking about. It's an interesting topic, but, in the time we have, can we refocus? Can we get back to, so there's a way to deflect that. I could say that, that's interesting, but in the limited amount of time we have, let's get back to the ministerial meeting coming up this fall in Qatar. One nice thing about editing, which I always try and do, is something called block editing, and that's taking out an entire question and answer, rather than internal editing, which is very labor-intensive, very hard to do, and opens up the possibility for lots of errors in terms of audio texture and flow. So if you look at that Stuart Ewan interview, you'll see at the end of it, I put in a thing, due to broadcast requirements, some portions of this interview were not aired, but I included it in the text. It's okay to include it in the text, but when you're up against a satellite structure, or even a live half-hour or one-hour time slot, you don't have certain luxuries.
Should you ever try the other kind, where you're going to take out some sentences of what somebody said and then possibly likely misconstrue what they're trying to say?
Does that
open you up to a criticism that you misrepresented what they said? You know, if you shorten
their answer or take out part of it.
Well, if you make an egregious error, mm-hmm. and I know you know the answer, you know. If you confuse GMOs with HMOs, mm-hmm. for example, I might edit that out and take certain sentences out.
Okay.
But that's very labor intensive. The ear is much more forgiving than the eye. You have to remember that. So now we're talking about print. The eye sees this thing, but this is not a sentence. What's the subject? What's the antecedent? What's this dangling participle? What is this sentence that begins here and ends there? I mean, the ear is going to forgive the way I'm speaking right now, kind of like in this, just droning on and on, you know, with occasional complete sentences and complete thoughts, but also dangling participles, no antecedents, you know, no references and things like that, no agreement between pronoun and verb. That the ear will let go. So that's the difference between an audio art and a written art. Like, I'm going to transcribe Ron Daniels' speech from last night, and I'm going to make that into English. But I'm not going to do that for the audio, because someone is speaking. It's okay. So all these interviews in here with Chomsky, we both sound like we're masters of English, because, you know, it's edited. It's, you know, there's a beginning, there's an end, there's a subject to the sentence, there's a verb. You know, things are explained. There are no run-on sentences and dangling participles, and, you know, no modifiers and things like that. So in print, we're able to manipulate the print, and I use a manipulate in a good way. You know, we want to come off coherent. We want to come off like, you know. So if I transcribe Daniel's speech verbatim, it'll be virtually unreadable. You know, what was the topic of this sentence? You know, it like began over there. And it seems to be ending, you know, down in, you know, Nantucket.